And now I'm here with Roger Akers. He's the co-founder of Akers Capital Management. What's the name of your company?
Akers Capital.
Akers Capital.
Technology-based capital investment.
Okay, so now you are a legend in the Sacramento area when it comes to investing and to venture capital. You helped form the Sac Angels. You were involved in the formation of the UC Davis Big Bang Competition, the Sacramento Regional Technology Alliance, SARTA. We were just talking about that. Good old SARTA. You co-founded Akers Capital in 1998. And I understand you like to hunt and fish. You're kind of like a man's man. Is that a fair way to describe you?
Well, maybe the signs of a misspent youth. I've had a lot of fun growing up and learned those skills, and we continue to have a lot of fun with them.
And you are a man who has overcome cancer, and you're a big supporter of the American Cancer Society and a lot of charitable stuff here in the region.
Sure am.
Yeah, and that is something I think that we all respect, appreciate, love you for. And you've got a wonderful wife of 38 years, two accomplished children, and I've only been married like 34 years. What's the secret to this long marriage? These last 4 years, it's actually gotten a little bit easier. But is there a secret to this longevity?
Well, pick a good one first, and then one that's a giver, not a taker.
Oh, yeah.
I'll tell you, she's the light of my life, and she's a hard worker, and she's just always has a great attitude, much better than my attitude, and always being very helpful.
Were you telling me that she was she's got like the most tenure at Kaiser here locally?
In the mother-baby group, yes.
Wow.
At Kaiser Roseville. She's kind of the one that's been there the longest.
She's sort of like the quarterback when the kid pops out. Is that?
Well, she's in that mother-baby group, and
okay.
So they do so many wonderful things for the moms in the local area, and you know, 550 plus babies a month. That's what the world she lives in.
Wow! And what she's doing for the world of babies, you're doing for the world of early stage companies. I want to talk about that. Maybe we can get your background, and then we'll get into. I want to educate our audience on. I'd like to like dive into the mind of a real investor, and maybe we can help a few of these startups and maybe even some potential angel investors along the way. So maybe start with your background, if you don't mind.
Well, just I was born and raised on a farm up in Idaho, and went to Idaho State University and got a degree in a CPA in accounting and an undergraduate degree in computer science, and then went got a job, and then was asked to come back to the university and work at the University Computer Center and start writing code and get my master's paid for free right after that. And so I did that and just met the most fantastic people, got the start in my life. And after a period of time, one of the gentlemen at that computer center was going to work for a national consulting firm in the East Coast of Philadelphia. And he said, why don't you come with me? And we moved from Pocatello, Idaho to downtown Detroit, Michigan.
Well, it's interesting to me that you were into computers, though the timing. We're talking about, is this early 80s?
No, this is in the late 70s.
Late
70s.
76,
77, 78.
Okay, so I'm in high school at this time, and basically we had one computer. It was in the math class. There was basically not computers at that time. We knew of them, but they were these gigantic machines.
Exactly.
That, basically didn't have the capabilities that an iPhone, you know, that even the most basic computer would have today.
That's correct. It was a very, very different environment than today.
And the time, I mean, think about the timing. You ever think about, like, the timing where the stuff that you were into at that time really was, you guys were in the process of shaping the world. You were at the cutting edge at the time when everything was getting ready to, like, explode.
It was just a great opportunity. And it just, you know, like many things, it's better to be lucky than good.
Hmm.
And I was the luckiest guy, still am the luckiest person you've ever met.
Okay, so you ended up going to Detroit, and you have this accounting information in your head, but you also know computers.
We went into Detroit, and we computerized a 32-campus community college district that was failing in the worst possible environment, inner city environments that you can think of. They were losing $30 million a year from theft of people that were stealing the monies that were being paid to the community college for people to register to take classes.
Oh, boy.
And we solved that problem.
With computers.
With computers.
Wow.
And then people had to be accountable. And we finished that project up. And I went to the University of Alaska system and as a consultant and put new financial systems in that environment. At a very young age, at 28, I got to go up to be fired because the people that were there before me, the consultants there before me, had really screwed it up. And I was sent up there to take the fall for their problems. And we pulled it off and got the financial systems installed in the University of Alaska system. I got to spend $70 million when I was 28 years old with along with some other guys. But we worked very, very hard. And my wife moved up there with me. And we got married while we were in Alaska. And it was just a great experience, made lifelong friends there. And in 2.5 years, we had a great success, got a contract extension. And then off I went to City and County of San Francisco with that same firm and had another good success, worked for Dianne Feinstein. And helped computerize the Sacramento or the San Francisco Municipal Railway, Muni, and helped put systems.
What was it like working for her?
Well, she was she was fair, but she's very, very, very smart and very, very, very tough. And the people around her, they were tougher and meaner than you can imagine. They were just snakes. But I will tell you, on the other hand, we got a lot of work done, and it became very, very successful.
What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. You probably, great memories, and what makes you better. Okay, so you had these successes, right? You built companies and sold them at some point, right?
I decided I was going to... I needed to change my life. We took that consulting company public, and I had three guys working for me, and they were employees of this consulting firm, like 8, 9, and 10, and I was employee 896, and they all made $3 million apiece when the company went public, and I made $300,000. Now, and I was, two of them, I were babysitting for the consulting company, and one guy was a really great guy, but I decided, if I'm going to work this hard, I got to go start my own. And so I moved back up to Boise, Idaho, and got a partner, and we started a company called ProData Incorporated. Did that for 12 years, 480 full-time consultants, about 110 contractors, 30% management consulting, 70% heavy systems development work, 40% public sector, 60% private sector. And we had seven, at the end in 95, 96, we had seven offices in the Western U.S. And we got to sell that to a company that won a geographic dispersion from Seattle. And they came in and took us out.
Nice.
And it was perfect time before all the big job boards and whatnot came in. They came in and just cashed us out and off we went. It was perfect.
Exciting times.
Had a great middle management team.
Yeah. Did you take some time off?
Yeah, my wife made me take some time off, and we horsed around for 6 months, and then I started doing consulting for Intel and Cisco Systems and helping them get greater added value out of their IT consulting services companies.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, we went and really started thinking about, I got challenged by a very, very bright gentleman at Intel, and he said, why don't you start a venture capital firm? If you won't come to work for Intel Capital, why don't you do that? And I'd been doing some due diligence work on companies for Intel. And they kind of helped facilitate that. And I got myself educated, took about a year to get educated, got a partner and a guy up in Boise. They're just a brilliant, always work with smarter people than you are. And this guy, I hit the jackpot with him. His name was Tom Lotzenheiser. And he was just a great partner when we started Acres Capital.
Wow. So Acres Capital today, talk to us about what this business is, and then maybe we can kind of go into lessons learned. I want you to, lay it on us today, if you will.
Well, in full disclosure, we had great success with the first fund and the second fund with Acres Capital, and we invested a lot of money in the local region and in Northern California and had some great successes with that. My partner, He never really enjoyed the confrontational aspects of investing, and he was really an operator.
Confrontational aspects of investing.
Well, you constantly are doing organizational development work.
Yeah.
If you're going to make a company work, sometimes people that are working in those companies can't be there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to change those, and you have a lot of work to do as a board member and as an investor. And so he decided not to do that any further after we started wrapping things up. So in 2016, I am doing more angel investing now.
Mm-hmm.
We wrapped up those investments. Everybody made a lot of money, and that was all a very successful enterprise. And now I'm doing that and some mergers and acquisitions work more on buy side as well as sell side M&A work just to keep busy.
Well, okay, so there's a little meat on the bone that you mentioned in terms of like firing a management team. The immediate sense is to, okay, so you're a VC. I'm going to have you put your VC hat on today because
sure,
angel investor might not have as much
No.
control.
Exactly.
But you've got yourself in position to have what, a board seat? Walk me through a hypothetical scenario. You don't have to walk me through an actual scenario unless you want me to. How would that work? And why aren't you, how are you immune to the confrontation thing?
Well,
firing an entrepreneur sounds like it'd be kind of hard.
Well, you're never immune from any of that. But I would just have to say that we, as you start developing a relationship with the people that you're going to make a significant investment in, and you look at them very, very carefully as who they are as individuals. I learned more about going out to dinner with them and the entrepreneur and their wife
mm-hmm.
for dinner than maybe in any other kind of circumstance, because you get to learn, are they kind to their spouse? Are they do the right thing in terms of how they characterize their lives to date, you know?
Are they nice to the server?
And you say, well, don't judge me. Well, you judge people a lot when you're in that investment role because, you know, number one, you're trying to make money and you're trying to invest in the right people, but you also have to figure out whether you can get along with them or not. There's been some very, very successful companies that I didn't invest in here, and they went on to make a great deal of money, but honestly, it just wasn't a good chemistry mix.
Yeah.
And then the reverse was also true. Like with Customer Link, people fell in love. We started working together. We had great character in the people that were the leaders in that company, and it just sustained itself and took off and became very, very successful.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned how you look at the entrepreneur and the subtle things, or maybe not so subtle, the way you treat your wife at dinner. I think that's the main thing I look at as well if I'm thinking about making an angel investment is this somebody that would be good for my backyard barbecue? So I have this vision of finding synergies among my portfolio companies where all my business partners are in my backyard and we all love each other and we all want to help each other. Is this somebody that would sort of fit in the backyard that would work at the peer level with my other portfolio companies and help one another? And so if I can't get that kind of respect or I'll call it coachability or love, the love quotient's too low, it's like, it might not be for me.
Well,
and I'll pass on them too.
Well, I'll give you a great example. I ran into a company that I just fell in love with over in Utah. And we were still pretty early in our thought process after coming out of the consulting world. And I just fell in love with this business model and these guys and the other investors that were coming in and whatnot. But we really didn't look at them closely enough at a technical level. And we went in and we lost everything. We lost $3 million.
Wow.
And you know, you know, hindsight's always great, right? But it's very, very interesting. If you knew 3 years later, if we knew what we had known 3 years later and applied it to our discipline at that point in time, we would have never invested in that company.
What
they
did you miss?
They weren't. We missed the fact that they were duplicitous people. They were just not honest. They were salesmen. They weren't really forever company people. They just wanted to get their money and move on, no matter how they got it. And I have to tell you, and they loaded the board. We didn't have complete control of that particular situation. It was a little bit bigger business. And I have to tell you, they loaded the board and they basically took $14 million from the initial investors, and it was over.
Wow.
And it was a very, very educational moment for us, because we had never lost, really, up until then.
Okay, so let's talk about building a board. So you're you and I have actually talked about this in the past with a couple other specific businesses in mind. But if you're building a board, let's say you're a company and, wow, early stage, it's getting rolling. When is it time to put together an actual board of directors beyond, you know, the minimum of you and your partner and maybe your wife or something?
You know, I think if you're serious and you're focused and you really have the model, and we'll talk about how to build that model a little bit later.
Okay.
But if you have your model built and you're ready to start executing, I think that's the time when you go in and put your initial board together, and maybe you qualify it when they come on to say, you know, maybe you're going to be on the board longer term or not. Mm-hmm. But, and then you start putting your task list. People love being on boards of directors. If it's not just to make a lot of money, but it's also to appeal to their egos. And so you get some great, fantastic people to be on your board. The problem with the CEOs, a lot of time, they're afraid to ask the board members to do work. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we bring to the table is we say, everybody on the board's gonna work really, really hard to make this business successful. And every time you walk into a meeting with your board, you have a list of things that you ask them to do and to take away with them that you want them to execute on before the next meeting.
I love it.
And I'll tell you, you work your board to death. You work them as hard as you work everybody else.
And you do that, let's say a nonprofit board, would you do it the same way?
Well, completely. A nonprofit board, you know, people, the motivations there may be just a little bit different.
Yes.
But nevertheless, if you're running a nonprofit and people are that committed to doing what it is you're doing, give them things to do.
Yes.
And you know what? They'll like it more because they become more vested.
All right. So I'm going to go back to the for-profit side of things. But I am the president of a couple of boards.
And yes, it's like,
sometimes these volunteers, they're tougher to wrangle.
Yeah. Okay,
so I'm an early stage company. It's time. I'm serious. I'm gonna get some. Let's say I'm gonna build something that's gonna eventually get some venture capital, and hopefully one day be worth a lot of money. Maybe even go public at some point. So I want to do it right. So size of the board, type of people that I need on my board. How do I think about the makeup of the board?
Well, there's two. You can go through two stages, and it works pretty well sometimes to do an advisory board before you have the formal board. The formal board usually is made up of investors that are actually putting money in that have a vested interest. Sometimes you can get an outside board member in there if you're gonna raise a good bit of capital to start developing that business. But irregardless, whether it's advisory board or a formal board, you want to have people that can do more than just give you money. You want people that have leverage in the marketplace. They know who your competition is. They know who the complementary players are in the marketplace that could help take you into channel along with these other companies to make and help get you to market quicker and lower your cost of customer acquisition. Those are the kinds of guys you want on the board.
You want people with industry experience or potentially maybe it's sales experience, which might go, a B2B, somebody who's built a B2B sales organization is going to be strong in most B2B companies.
Yeah, and I think another characteristic that's also good, particularly when you're in second and third tier environments versus maybe Silicon Valley, is you need the investors that actually also have syndication relationships with bigger investors in case you need more money into the future, where you can syndicate into investments from other larger entities and move the company further if you need that $10 million round or that $20 million round as you're expanding.
You bet. Okay, so you have your board of directors, and you're going to keep that closed. It's typically investors into the company, the founders and the founder, the founding CEO, and maybe a few other investors. Want to keep it small?
You know, usually the optimal, in my opinion, there's a magic number with three, but that's very hard to get away with when you're talking about boards of directors.
Mm-hmm.
But if that's direct reports, that's another thing. But if it's boards of directors, I think the magic number is 5.
Okay.
And so you have that odd number, and you can, when you have a vote, there's always going to be a winner and a loser, unless there's some covenant that needs a unanimous vote. But I think 5 is a great number of directors, and you get a lot of work out of 5 people, right?
5 people works a couple pizzas, and you know, you can get something done, roll up the sleeves.
Exactly.
Okay, so now the difference between that and the advisory board, obviously the board of directors has actual control. They can hire and fire the CEO, which is, you must have, if you're the CEO, you're the majority shareholder, the person that started this thing typically, you want to put people on there that are going to help you to do your job better, but also, aren't we concerned about, hey, this group of people could fire me if I'm not doing my job?
Well, that's true. But I think I'd characterize it more as accountability and helping that CEO become more accountable. And then he then has the leverage to hold his environment and the people that work for him accountable. Mm-hmm. And that whole accountability structure is very, very important for a successful company to develop. And it, there's a lot of leverage to be gained from that.
And in case you're just joining us, just a few minutes ago, Roger said he was the non-confrontational one and that he wouldn't have problem firing the leadership team. And his partner was actually the guy that didn't like to face the confrontation. Mm-hmm. I say that jokingly because it's got to be tough if you have to, you have a fiduciary responsibility to the company and to the shareholders as a board of directors. And there's got to be times when the management team, the CEO, does need to be changed out. Look at what happened with McDonald's just recently, where the CEO had this relationship with one of his direct reports inside the organization. It's against the policy. Sorry.
If you think of the makeup of what a potential entrepreneurial CEO is and what animal, what beast that really is, It's very, very interesting to characterize them as you go along with more and more experience with more and more people that you meet. And I have to tell you, those people that are CEOs, I mean, that want to take that level of risk, if they're product-based companies versus services, we'll talk about that a little bit later.
Okay.
But if they're product-based businesses, a lot of times those CEOs are engineers. Mm-hmm. And they're the guys that they love tinkering and making things better and boiling the ocean more and more and more to have more and more features on that product that they're developing. But at the end of the day, when they have to really start managing people and setting expectations with people and holding people accountable and raising money, oh, why should I have to go raise money? My product is so perfect, I shouldn't have to raise money. They should just give it to me. Well, those kinds of people, sometimes you have to transition them and let them become a CTO and put somebody in that can do business development, that can raise money and give that leverage to other people. Even if you still own a big chunk of the stock as that engineering-oriented original CEO, maybe you need to let somebody else take over that can drive the business forward.
I'm invested into a company that's like that today, and we've already been talking about that kind of thing. But it's coming from the CEO. The CEO is sort of saying, look, I'm the product guy, and we probably need to bring in somebody who can take this thing to market.
But see how great that is, though.
Humility. Yeah.
Self-effacing, realizing that they're not good at those things. So let me do what I'm good at, and let's get somebody in here that can do the other things that they need to be good at. And I'll tell you, if you can find that guy, that's a hard guy to find because a lot of times their ego gets so wrapped up into being the boss that they kind of forget what they're good at.
Yeah, humility, so important. Okay, so the advisory board, let's bounce over to that. So you've got your board of directors, got it, check. When is it time to bring an advisory board in? Is that another set of people that I got to meet with every so often?
You know, I think you can do it. You can do the advisory board before you get your formal board in place, before you've raised a significant amount of money, before you have those constraints.
Okay.
And you can help leverage those people to help you find angel investors. You can use those people to help do your channel development work. And people that maybe want to invest a little bit of money as you're just getting started. And that advisory board can be so valuable on the front end before you get formalized with a heavy formal board. But you made a very, very important point. Even after you get your formal board put in place, there's still a place for an advisory board to that helps the company grow and develop. If you can find people that are passionate about what it is you're doing, it is so invaluable. And they can actually put informal pressure on the formal board of director and the investors to do things in terms of how the business is evolving and help the company evolve. Whereas sometimes those board members are sitting there going, well, I don't know if we want to make those changes just now. It's going to cost more money. Yeah. And the informal advisory board or the regular advisory board is saying, come on, you got to make that change. You have to pivot right here to catch that wave to make, yes, to do what you need to do. I've seen it work, and it just is so much fun to watch that leverage of the advisory board into the formal board.
Well, how do you, okay, so you need to have people who can be additive in your advisory board. Is it a requirement typically that they invest? I mean, do you give the, what's their incentive to really put their heart and soul into
it? I think a vested interest is pretty important, but at the same time, there's something called sweat equity. And if they want to work really hard and not put any cash in, but they want to work really hard without being an employee, then maybe that'll work too.
Okay, so this is like an angel investor who doesn't have any money.
Maybe
it's allocated elsewhere.
Or maybe he has a job.
Yeah.
You know, or maybe whatever. Right. But at the same time, he says, I've got value that I can bring to the table to help you be successful, and I'm passionate, yes, about what you're doing. What a great person is that to have.
Bring me a sliver. Give me a sliver of the upside, and it's worth it. Okay, interesting.
It works.
So, and how big should that board be? Five?
Oh, I think five's good.
Okay.
I mean, the problem that you start running into, how much time does the CEO have to communicate to that advisory board? Because he's got to communicate to his formal board, and then he's communicating to his entire organization.
Mm-hmm.
And you better be a great communicator if you've got all those people to keep educated and
tell
keep
me
working.
About it. I mean, in some of our portfolio companies, they're great at reporting, and others don't. I think they didn't know that they were supposed to do any reporting, or that it was, you know, kind of customary. So it's interesting. I'm learning as an angel investor too what to ask for from my portfolio companies. I mean, when you invest, do you require, is there some sort of requirement that says, hey, give me at least a monthly or quarterly financials? I mean, how do you do that as an investor?
Well, again, I'm a little bit different than maybe some just newer angel investors or whatever. So, but this is something that works like a charm. But we actually, for those early stage companies, I actually dictate the financial model I want them to use,
mm-hmm,
and say, here's your model. Here's your pro forma financial model that you can measure yourself against. Here's your chart of accounts that I'd like you to use when you're keeping your books.
Yeah.
And so do this.
That's a prerequisite.
I think that is.
Yeah.
And it doesn't happen every time.
Yeah.
But a lot of times they're sitting there going, why would they want to do that?
Yeah, why not? And if you're going to give them the template.
Exactly.
Is that something that, like, I like getting reports monthly on my companies versus quarterly?
I didn't answer your question.
Yeah.
You know, so I as often as you could get it, without having the company, here's a big problem. I know, guys, I want to have a board meeting every month. Well, maybe early on you do for the first 3 months or so. But you know how much time CEOs and the rest of the staff spend putting their presentations together for a board meeting?
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah.
When they should be doing real work for a living. So at the end of the day, you kind of have to be careful about what you ask for, how much you ask, and how often you ask for it, because a lot of times it could be a drag on the business.
You bet. Okay, so a lot of things we want to talk about. We talk about the board a little bit. In terms of founding team, so what I see in entrepreneurship, is I look at a lot of companies as well, and typically there's somebody at the CEO level that loves the product, like you were saying. A lot, it's not always the product person, but a lot of times the person with the original idea sort of is the product person. And many times that person ends up starting off as the CEO. Mm-hmm. Who else needs to be on his or her team? I mean, if you're rounding out your executive team, your that initial startup team, what's necessary?
Well, obviously, you want the very best that you can possibly get, right? But
and you usually can't pay them either.
And you can't pay them, and then you've got to do all kinds of unnatural acts relative to that, right?
Yeah.
But You want it, the best people you can find. If you've got to have people that can help that CEO do business development and sales, start figuring out how you're going to sell what it is you're building. You have to have people that are very, very focused on watching the money.
Yeah.
Not too many, but mm-hmm. just enough to watch the money. And then you have your product people. And how much product development needs to be done going into the next 18 months mm-hmm. versus when are you going to be able to start selling product, and how much money do you need to do that? And that whole, we'll give you that whole characterization here in a minute. But at the end of the day, you want your product, you have to have those product people. You have to have people that can sell things and look at it in a realistic way. And you have to have somebody to keep the books. Yeah. And if that's three people, that's three people when you're starting.
Yeah.
But you get the best people you possibly can. To do that, but you don't compromise on those initial hires. Just here's one thing I just have to say, it's part of my mantra. If you hire one person out of three that work out in your organization, you're average. If you get two out of three, you're better than everybody else. And if you get three out of three, you're lying to yourself. You really, really, the time, the opportunity cost and the time that it takes you to hire another person to replace a person that's already on board, and the whole cost of doing all of that and all that relationship building that you have to redo and redo, it's just a tremendously
difficult
cost.
Very selective, yeah, extremely selective.
Be very selective, but also be quick. My problem is I'm the most loyal person in the world. And I hated letting people go, even if they were wrong. I'd repurpose them. I'd try to do things with them to allow them to be successful doing something else. But I have to tell you, if you look back on some of those people, you are doing them a favor by firing them or having them laying them off so they could go start somewhere else and go be successful somewhere else where they weren't going to be successful here. And I know that's a rude thing to say, but at the end of the day, I wished in a number of circumstances that I would have moved faster than slower.
What about bringing on people? So you've got this great idea, and I'm thinking, okay, I need to bring on some business partners. I'm not good at everything. Maybe I'm not good at selling and marketing. I'm a little concerned about the finance thing, but I think I've got something with this product. These people that sort of fit the mold for chemistry with me, they have good jobs. They get paid six figures, and I have no revenue, and I haven't raised money yet. Do I give up equity? How much? Especially if I'm going to be letting them go, one out of three times. How do you go through? How do you process those kind of decisions?
Well, that's a very big question. But maybe to start off with, when you're building your rationalization for building your company, because you're living it every single day. You're eating and breathing. Everything you do is focused on building that company. And it's just, it's a wonderful thing to watch for me. I get very excited about watching people go through that process. But you have to build a cohesive rationalization for yourself so that you know what you're believing in really and what it is you're really going to go do. And so how do you build that rationalization? And I think that that's just so important, because who do you have to convince? The people that you want to hire. If you have a great rationalization and you say, this is what I'm going to go do, and they look at it and say, well, I'd like to go help you do that. That's pretty darn good.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing better, by the way. And then you start talking to investors. You start talking to customers. And you start selling that rationalization in those different areas, and suddenly you find out what resonates and what doesn't. And you get to massage and model and reset and pivot. And by the time you go through that process, you have something that gets pretty exciting.
Yeah.
And I would just say, I'm being a bit long-winded on this thing, but the way I go through that is there's just paint a quadrant up here, okay? And in the upper left quadrant, to me, I call that market segmentation analysis. And the lower left quadrant is product. Now, a good entrepreneur knows exactly what he's building, what they're building, and what's going to fit in that. And they're very, very good at understanding their product. And so you come up to this next quadrant up here, and you look at market segmentation analysis. You need to study your competition in detail. Well, I don't have any competition. Oh, yes, you do. There's some competition in some way out there somehow. And you're going to go out and study that competition or the companies that are kind of similar to what it is you're doing. You're also going to look at complementary companies that can help, that are doing something not what you're doing, but something similar that help can help take you into channel and lower your cost of customer acquisition as you're getting ready to go to market. And they're going to love helping you to go to market because it helps them find out who that is. And right there in that same vein, you want to find out what you're selling. A lot of these SaaS companies and technology companies today have four or five different revenue channels that can be developed over a over a period of time with those businesses. Figure out what your revenue channels are, and then start figuring out what your cost of customer acquisition really is. You know, this whole SEO advertising mechanism, go read a book, go read five books on that, because it's transforming retail. It's transforming the way we think about business development out there in the world. Having said that, sorry, the you do a great job of understanding those things, and you have then you're able to look at the people that you're going to need and put an org chart together and start thinking about time and people to accomplish this and product. And now you are starting to get a picture of what this business is going to look like and the kind of people that you need when.
Mm-hmm.
And then the lower left or the lower right quadrant is your financial model. And you model that thing down to the cat's pajamas and you know exactly where every nickel is every minute. And you do estimated versus actual on a month-to-month basis. Now you have a rationalization and you sound like you know what you're doing. People will give you the money. Customers are interested, suppliers are interested, and the people you want to hire are interested.
Okay, so people will give me the money. I've got the advisory board, I've got my management team, the initial leadership team, the product, I've got my cost of acquisition for a customer, I've got the modeling going. Now I'm going out to, it's time for me to go get some money from some other people so that I can have some runway to build out this team. What... first steps. Do I go out after the? I'm a tech company. Do I go out after the local angels? What do you think?
The very first thing I would do. There's two kinds of businesses in the world to me. There's services-based businesses and product-based companies, and we tend in this forum to talk more about product-based businesses. Okay, early stage tech, product. But raising money in the early stage, product-based environments. The very first, that board that you spent a lot of time trying to put together to help you build your rationalization and do the right things, whether it was an advisory board or starting to be a more formal board, the very first thing you do is you challenge them to help you raise money. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing what a great conduit that is, because now you've convinced other people to believe in what it is you're doing. Yeah. And the minute you do that, and the train's leaving the station.
You've hired a sales force.
And soon as you get that mentality going around your environment that you're convincing, they start talking to grandpa, and they start talking to this, and they start talking to that. You go then talk to the lawyers in town, and you talk to the CPAs in town, and you tell them what you're doing.
So having somebody on your advisory board or your advisory board that is connected, and you mentioned this earlier, connected to the other money, but connected even to that first round, that seed stage financing is going to come with the help of the advisory board in many cases.
I absolutely believe that that's actually the key. Because those are the people that you've really spent your time and effort to educate the first time around.
Mm-hmm.
And all you need is somebody else to say, well, I think that guy knows what he's doing. And now you've got two people. And now it grows exponentially. And pretty soon you have a lot of people saying, yeah, we better watch that one. That's pretty important business there. And then when that happens, you start being asked to go here and go there and to talk to this person and talk to that person. And then you might go to the Sacramento Angels, or you might go to other investment environments where you can raise money pretty effectively.
So when do I start paying myself? Okay, so I go out, raise $500,000 from friends, family, advisory board, some angels. I've got $500,000. I've got two employees. So there's three of us.
You start paying yourself when you need to.
Mm-hmm.
when you need to be paid and you have money to pay you, that's when you start paying yourself. But you want to reinvest every dollar you can back into your business. And if you need money to survive, take it, because without you, it's nothing. But and everybody will understand that 100%.
So we're staying on the product business, the one that you're going to go out and raise some money with. We'll stay on that, and then I'll let you switch back over to the services, because I know that you have a different opinion on that. So so you start to pay yourself, and how much runway do you need? Because you know you're starting to get sales, but it's not clear yet how fast sales are going to go. And you've got three employees now, including yourself, which is, you know, that's a pretty good cost. You're still developing the product. There's some investment dollars there. Shoot, we're going to run out of money in 12 months if we're not careful.
Well, a mistake that's made, oftentimes a mistake that's made is the entrepreneur he's out raising money, and he'll find a couple of early investors, and they'll say, when are you going to close the round? How much money do you need? Well, I don't need very much. And then, okay, well, we're going to give you the money, but you need to close the round, right? Don't do that. Go to your model, figure out how much money you need, raise that amount of money. Don't compromise on needing the right amount of money just because that's all. I mean, it is hard work to go raise money, and you get tired of it, but don't give up.
Some people dread that.
You should. It's hard to do. How would you like to talk to me every day? But the other side of it is, don't compromise on how much money you need just because you can get it and you can start doing some real work for a living instead of what's in the model.
Right.
Build the model. Get the money that you need and live it and keep talking to people until they give you the money.
And explain to us why an investor wants you to close out the round.
Because they get a higher percentage of the business as soon as
they close
it
out, and then it goes up in value in the next round.
And it's mind-boggling sometimes how duplicitous that can be, and from an investor standpoint. And you just can't allow that to happen if you're a great entrepreneur. Just keep on plugging, keep working hard, keep selling, keep building and refining that rationalization, and get all you need, just so you know. Go get a customer and say, I have a customer. First day you say you have a customer, you'll be able to start raising a lot of money, just so you know. That was a hard one to learn, but go get a customer.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of companies now they're very interested in getting proof of concept. You get the minimum viable product out there, and you get some customers. They're not as focused on margin and making money at the beginning. Want to get the product out there. I mean, is that typically what you advise people? Is hey, just get some customer feedback, or should you go out there and hold your margin at the beginning?
Well, you know, I'm biased on that one. I never sell based on price, but know how much you should be charging for what it is you're selling. Remember the market segmentation analysis that we did up here?
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me tell you need to figure out why you're selling what you're selling and why you're selling it for. And it's because of the value you're creating for whatever it is you're selling. So figure that out.
Mm-hmm.
And just a couple of guidelines in that arena. If it's a product-based business, if you should be generating, and I could argue all day long on this one, but if you should be generating somewhere between 60 and 65% gross margin on a product-based business. And that's a good thing to hang your hat on. And you go in and we go evaluate a company and they're only doing 50% gross margin. Well, why is that? And you can drill into that and figure that out. And in your pro forma model, now remember, you're spending at those early days, you're trying to spend everything you can to reinvest back in the business. But let's not forget that we're trying to make a buck too downstream, or at least measure a buck at the net. Profit level, EBITDA level. And that number for a product-based business should be somewhere around 20%.
EBITDA.
Yeah.
Yep. So 20% EBITDA. Obviously, they're just getting into the game, early stage company. I don't know what my EBITDA. I'm just hoping for a dollar of EBITDA. So, but yes, and when I model it out and I'm, at 20 million in sales or 50 million in sales, I need to be throwing 20% to the bottom line. But what about the guy that comes in with my philosophy and maybe like suck them in and inch them up, right? The freemium model where I'm going to kind of give it away. I'm going to make it on sale 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And instead of on the first sale. When you hear that guy, do you walk away or how do you feel?
I'm biased on that because I think if you're generating real value, you need to be able to go sell it. And you need to walk in and sell it to that customer and say, "This, you need this, and you need to buy this, and it's worth this." Mm-hmm. You know, it's so hard to raise prices after you've lowered them. And even salespeople, to make the sale, "Oh, you allow me to lower the price?" Well, it's kind of a cultural problem that you get yourself into. And I, in any one certain business versus another, if you have to do that to get the first sale, then whatever. I will just challenge you a little bit on that one, though, Mark. On that first sale, why not go into that customer and say, "We'll develop that, our product for you. We'll keep the proprietary rights, but we'll develop the product for you."
Right.
What about for cost?
Okay.
And we'll give it to you for cost if you'll pay for the development of it. And then we're going to go back out and resell it, the daylights out of it, to all these other environments.
Yeah.
I'll tell you,
I like
that's
that.
Not a bad idea, you know, versus like walking in and saying, "Well, we'll give you a 20% discount if you'll buy it today."
Yeah, no, I like that for sure. There's all kinds of ways to skin a cat. But what about like a direct-to-consumer model where, you know, you're going to have trouble really even paying for much of a sales force. It's going to be a little bit more online marketing and so on, and then hope to figure out a way to, you know, you just need to get it you just need to get a little bit of market share so you can get a buzz going.
You do.
Do you stay away from those kind of companies?
No, I've been in those kind of companies. I wouldn't. My niece will not like this because she did the first SEO advertising development for Lululemon and made a giant fortune off of doing its one account.
Wow.
Okay, but all I'm trying to say is, if you have the right budget and you raise the right amount of money for the product that you're selling out in the marketplace, even if it's a direct-to-consumer, now you have enough money to go out there and execute and sell it and hold your value while you're going out there and doing it. But just as we all know when we're entrepreneurs, some days we have to do whatever we have to do in order to make it happen, and so we have to compromise. If you're an entrepreneur, you're going to learn compromise.
Yeah, the textbook might get set off to the side while we just try to stay alive here.
Exactly.
Okay, so keeping this rolling a little bit, you know, we could. I mean, there's so many ways to take this conversation. So one of the things that's you know, we're thinking about is developing the MVP, and like that has to happen pretty quick, right? Do you have like a philosophy on that?
Say that again.
The minimum viable product, how fast that should be done, or things that we need to be thinking about when we're doing that?
Well, no, okay. I really don't, and I'm being a little flippant when I say that, because until you have a minimum viable product that you can actually go out and start selling, you're just not there yet.
Okay.
And
if you haven't made a sale, you're not there yet.
No.
It's something that someone would actually hand you money for.
Yes, but whether you've sold it or not, if you have something you believe in and you've rationalized and you think there's value creation there and you've spent a lot of money and time and effort making that happen, then it's going to be good enough. Your bigger it's really not the problem. It's hard to come just up with a minimum viable product. Most of the time, these engineering CEOs and entrepreneurs, they want to boil the ocean and they want to put every friggin' bell and whistle they possibly can on that product before they're ready to go to market. You have to hold them back so that you can then upsell them as you go. That's where the upsell occurs.
That's my inch them up.
But there you go. But it's so important that you hold and just where can you. When do you have a product that can actually be sold?
Yeah.
And then start adding bells and whistles?
Okay. So now your company's going, it's maturing, and you're now, the foundation is built, and now you're ready to scale, right? Obviously, you've proven yourself to a little bit, and maybe you've been proving yourself to some outside investors. They're starting to want to dump fuel on the fire. And you want to optimize your growth. I mean, any thoughts around the principles associated with, hey, how do you optimize growth?
I'm working on a project right now with an entrepreneur out in Davis. And it's a I won't mention the name, but it's a great little company. It's $12 million a year. Mm-hmm. They're growing by 30% a year. It's a product-based company. Great. They're making money. It's really good. But now it's time to become a $100 million company. It's that time for a lot of reasons. And the problem is, do you know that guy, that CEO that's worked so hard? Nobody's ever going to be able to do anything that he does better than him. He's got a lot wrapped up into creating $12 million in revenue, I'll tell you. Now you have to go, it just one, this is a metaphor conversation, but you have to go hire and staff an inside sales operation. Do you know how much that entrepreneur that's built a $12 million revenue company, do you know how much he despises inside salespeople during the first year of their being hired? Because they can never, ever do it as well as he. Hmm. And the conflicts that are generated in that kind of environment and some of the problems that have existed there. And that's where that board of directors is so important, to hold that CEO entrepreneur down and say, just let it happen, just let it happen, just let it happen, and let that take its course and let the inside salespeople do their job and keep wrapping the CEO in the flag and hauling him out there to do biz dev with big customers or big suppliers, but keep him kind of away from that inside sales group that can go out there and do massive sales. And I'll tell you, it is one of the hardest things for those guys to do is to let that go, because here they are spending all that money. Do you know what I could do with that money?
And you're bringing in $15 to $20 an hour salespeople that are making some money on commission, and they're motivated, they're hungry to make sales, and they need to get in and start making sales, you know, in the first week with an inside sales force. And so they're not going to be perfect.
These are $40,000 a year people that want to make 110.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean on commission?
Yes. So they're not as polished or as sophisticated as the CEO. They certainly don't know the product if they're brand new. But a good inside salesperson can start paying for themselves pretty quickly if turned loose with the right tools and so on.
And right education.
Yes.
And all of that. But I have to tell you, it is extremely hard for that entrepreneur CEO to let go. And that's where that board just pays off so much, that they understand that principle to just help him allow that to occur and get it through till the point, till it starts generating results. But then you have to have somebody running that organization that can take and make quick decisions on hiring and constantly be doing the education process. But if you have to get rid of somebody, remember the 1 in 3 rule.
Mm-hmm.
How do you build 7 inside salespeople quickly enough? How many people do you have to go through to do that? 14? Well, that's a lot of work to do that that type of recruiting and to get those people up to speed and actually productive.
Well, you know, that's an interesting thing, because if the CEO is not helping drive the culture, if he doesn't like the sales force, he doesn't like the concept of selling and hiring an inside sales force, that's a cultural issue. And if the CEO is not driving that culture, who does? Who is driving that culture, Roger?
Well, he already built a lot of that culture when he built the $12 million revenue model, because he built it all himself. He pulled the wagon of rocks up the hill himself. Yeah. Now he's going to let other people go out and do that on an expansive basis.
So I'm guessing he's got 20 to 25 employees, and he needs to be at 100 employees within the next 3 years. That's a whole nother skill set than developing a product and having 20 people that think that you're the smartest guy in the world and they love you for it.
That's right.
And you've helped make them rich to a certain extent, right? They've got some equity in this thing.
They do.
And now you've got to hire a whole different set of people that, that's a whole different game.
That are going to be suddenly a lot more valuable than some of the people that are already there.
Okay. I'm getting the signal from Brian that I'm going to move on to the next topic here. So we talked about leadership somewhat. We haven't spoken about management. So, and I think in these companies that begin to scale a little bit, you end up, there's a difference between leaders and visionaries and management. You have thoughts on that?
We've always got a thought on about everything, you know, but, leadership showing people that you're willing to take a risk, to me, that's leadership. I mean, that guy's going to really do that? I mean, there's not that many people that really know how to take risk and measure levels of risk. There's just not that many of them out there. That's a key differentiating factor. And when you're demonstrating leadership, everybody looks at risk takers and say, there's a guy. I want to follow him. He's willing to do it. Right.
I think of the metaphor of, the leading from the front. We can all picture that person leading at the front of a charge. And then you can picture somebody at the back of the thing kind of cracking the whip going, come on, guys, get out there and get it. So kind of like the push versus pull. Right. I mean, was that a fair analogy?
I think so. That is a fair analogy. But, you know, the people, the guys that lead with a whip, with small early stage companies in particular, I have to tell you, I've never seen too many of those successful, and I hope I took your point correctly. Yeah. I've just never seen that. I'd rather teach my people how to be lucky. If I were a leader, teach them how to be lucky. You know, it's a skill to learn how to be lucky.
How do you do it?
It's a skill to communicate to people and get to sell the rationalization. You can turn people in your company into evangelists on what it is you're doing. And they believe it. I've had people believe it more than I've believed it, you know, in building companies. And they just take over and they say, that I believe in that, and we're going to go make that happen.
I mean,
it's one of the most exciting things in business. But teaching people and being to be evangelists and teaching them how to be lucky and how to just keep sell on everything that they're doing. And do it in an intelligent way, I think, is just important. Management, on the other hand, versus leadership, I think managers, there's the hard part of business when people aren't the right people, where you have to measure people's success and how they're doing and what it is they're doing. If you can work as hard as you possibly can in educating and training people and showing them what it is you want them to do, but at the end of the day, you start measuring their success and figuring out whether they're being successful in what they're doing and try to modify them. If they're not being successful, let them do something else. But at the end of the day, and those are all management processes that you have to put in place that the company can rely on. And so many people don't really understand. You talk about culture, putting a set of objectives in place and a set of management criteria in place so they know how they're going to be managed is absolutely critical for people. And they live it. Anything you can give them, they're just like, they're hungry to have something to hold on to. In one of our most successful companies, we coined the term the critical success factors. We had 13 critical success factors.
Oh boy.
If you do everything on the list, you'll never be fired.
Oh boy, 13.
13.
That's a lot.
But you had to help recruit people into the company. You had to dress appropriately. You had to take education and training. You had to get more educated and more trained, no matter who you were in the company, and help with new business development, even though you had a job being a technical consultant, and on and on and on. Once you set that kind of management criteria in place, people live it. They want it.
Yes.
And you might. A lot of people say, I don't want to be managed. Let me tell you, people love being managed.
They want structure.
They want
deep
structure.
Down,
and
they want
to be managed.
They want structure. But the other thing, a lot of people that are good with the structure, laying things out, making things organized, they don't have that ability to demonstrate what I'll call insane commitment, where it's like, I am going to do this. I am going to run. We are going to do this. We are going to run through a brick wall, and we are going to change the world. And there's some people that have the ability to sort of exemplify and live, breathe that insane commitment. And it's attractive. People will follow that that passion and that commitment. And others, they may be just as committed, but they have trouble sort of displaying that so that others want to jump on board. Some people just have trouble I guess, conveying that message or that belief through an organization.
But there's other things that they can do. If they're not good at that type of projection, there's other things that they can do to make it successful, to help make the company successful. I mean, in just doing the core job that they've been asked to do in the beginning, working with people inside. I had a technical guy, and he's that guy. He was quiet, didn't have a lot to say, absolutely brilliant. He trained people. We'd have people go sit at a desk. You go sit at the desk for 3 hours with that guy and have him teach you X on a different types of coding, different kinds of structural development work for IT development. I'm going to tell you, one of the most successful things we ever did with the company overall, we had people flying in from other places so he could teach them. Do you know what that turned that guy into? He was the biggest advocate for our company that existed, maybe, because he would tell all the technical development people in the whole town, hey, I'm working for those guys, and this is what I'm doing. And they would all go, wow, I wished I could do that.
All right, Roger, as we wrap up, I want to say thanks for coming on the show, but also any words of wisdom, closing advice to somebody out there that is thinking, okay, I'm ready, I think this is my time. Any last closing thoughts for them?
Well, the very first thing that you should do as you're going through your thought process, figure out what you are. Are you truly going to build a product-based business? That's a pretty sexy conversation, but there's a lot of very successful services-based businesses out there, even services-based businesses that have a product catalyst, and it's very important for you to figure out who you are. And then you can start building your rationalization that we talked about before. But how you are funded relative to being a services-based business versus being a product-based business are completely different.
Yeah.
And the services-based model is one where you're going to use more debt and less equity to fund that over a period of time, but you're also only generating 30 to 35% gross margins on those kind of businesses with a 10% net. Okay, versus a product-based business that's, as we talked about before, 60, 65% gross margin and a 20% net. And so that's funded with a lot more equity, and the growth curve of those types of companies usually are a lot quicker. But you can make a lot of money with each. But you just need to determine who you are and what you are.
Does it take a lot longer to build a larger service-based company than it does a product-based company? It can take more time?
Well, it's all relative, though, because a good product-based business, most of those take 5, 6, 7 years. And let me tell you, a services-based company that's growing 30% a year, they can be a nice little $25, $30 million business after 5, 6 years, and you're throwing off $5 million in cash, and how happy are you?
A guy can have a lot of fun with $5 million in cash every year. Roger, thanks for sharing your story. Always a pleasure. I hope we can have you back on the show again soon.
I'd like that very much. Thank you.